Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jim Harrison, whose latest novel is Returning to Earth. Jim Harrison is the author of several books, I think 9 novels at this point.
Yes.
Collections of short stories, poems, essays, a memoir, and several screenplays. 2 of his works have become films, insofar as I know there may be others. Wolf and Legends of the Fall.
Yeah, also Revenge years ago with that movie made in Mexico with Kevin Costner and Madeline Stowe.
Anthony Quinn is a ghost?
Yeah, Anthony Quinn. An argument over a woman. It's sort of a biological movie.
Returning to Earth was, in a sense, a sequel to another book, True North.
True.
It struck me in reading Returning to Earth that not having read the earlier book changed the emphasis of the story, because had I read the book, I would have been looking at the character of David Burkett as the main character.
I knew I was going to need a second volume, but I did that with Dalva and The Road Home, too. But I purposely made this to be read utterly independently also. I could just see that I wanted to get fully out of David's mind. I wanted to get down actually where these people lived on a day-to-day basis, their ordinariness, whereas True North was an obsessive book about a young man that feels deeply the destruction of his family is wreaked on the Upper Peninsula, you know, in terms of mining and timbering and so on.
The beginning of the book focuses on a character named Donald, who's
right.
The husband of the sister of this character, David Burkett. But as the book progresses, it moves more and more in the direction of the material that does appear in True North.
Right.
It's almost as if you were forced to go in that
Well, direction. I wanted to idea. It's one thing, David's obsession in True North about the damage caused by his family, his ancestors, is that hence resolved in the actual life of a half-Finnish, half-Anishinaabe, half-Chippewa construction worker, Cynthia's husband. And it's one thing to say this damage was terrifying, but then it's another thing to say this is how people made their living. We're actual human beings, you know. We're not abstractions, which David tended always to think of in abstractions. That's why he was liberated from the horrors of his family by doing that very simple thing of distributing survival kits to Mexicans wanting to go north. You know, he finally did something that you could put your hands on.
You were born in Upper Michigan?
Yeah.
Yeah, and most of your novels, many of your novels, I guess, take place in that area,
yeah.
Very few people write about.
This is not a storied place in that sense. The Upper Peninsula, particularly. Hemingway, oddly enough, wrote his big two-hearted river story up there after World War I. He was a tourist from Chicago, see?
The sense I get in reading Returning to Earth is that because it's fairly sparsely populated and lots of forests and lots of Native American culture, it takes on an almost mystical aura. Yeah.
Well, not to them it doesn't, because there's no one. Native Americans, you can't talk about them generically. Say, Anishinaabe, the Chippewas, are preposterously non-mystical people. The history of the culture is almost the history of the land. The land is destroyed. The culture is destroyed. You know, there are 532 language groups. Many have disappeared. Concurrent with the destruction of land was the destruction of the people.
And that's the mining?
Mining, forests, logging.
What's it like up there now?
It's quite lovely in a sort of beat-up way. I had a cabin there 25 years, and I would say 99% of my hikes or more in 26 years, I never saw another human being. None. That's nice. But the stumps, the ghost stumps, I begin to think that they're almost like the ghosts of Buffalo, these enormous white pine stumps, you know, everywhere from when they were cut 100 years ago, all of them.
The book takes place in 1995. Why did you choose to set it?
Well, I wanted to continue where True North left off, sort of, that idea. And also, I needed that distance. I wrote something in my journal the other day. I didn't quite understand it at first. We must remove ourselves from the sentimentality of the contemporaneous. It's hard to have any lucid perception, say, of where you are now as you move along. So I needed that 10 years to look backward.
It almost seems that when Bush came in 2001 and then we had 9/11, that a lot of perception changed, not at all in a positive way, and it almost feels as if the 90s become idyllic.
I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but that is more of an urban perception. I noticed that strikingly in New York.
There's a line that your character, Cynthia, says in teaching. She decides to leave teaching because she said, it seems that the only purpose is to create employees.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, that's what they're asked to do, is to create fodder for the economy.
The book is also about death and about how one deals with death and dying. What prompted you to write that?
There's been a great deal of death in our family, as there is in every family. You know, my father and sister were killed in an auto accident when he was 53 and she was 19. And my brother died a couple of years ago. And also, in my little nickel-plated Zen training early on, there's that old Zen dictum that you should relive your death every morning and then it won't come as any surprise. It only takes a split second to imagine yourself dead, you know. So it's very refreshing. And I thought, this is a culture that is largely ignored, tries to ignore death, therefore it doesn't know how to grieve, it doesn't know how to deal with death. There's that ghost supper thing that the Chippewas do that I've attended, where you throw tobacco on the fire to release the ghosts of your beloved ones, because they don't want to stay here. You're holding their spirits here. You have to let them go. But that's for you. You have to let them go. As Lauren Isley said so powerfully, we love the earth, but we couldn't stay.
The characters there wonder if the character of Donald is in a bear, and Cynthia makes a comment, was, I like dogs, does that mean I have to deal with inhabiting
yeah,
a dog?
But see, they're very practical, these people. That's what, again, the title, Returning to Earth, because, you know, I don't want like to talk about somebody else's religion, but bear medicine is very, very heavy medicine. It chooses you. You don't choose it. And it's the daughter in the particular, Claire, that wishes to think perhaps her father has become a bear, which is not unheard of at all. You know, there's Rockwell's book, Giving Voice to the Bear, is interesting. The position of the bear in native cultures, all native cultures, is very prominent. Because, you know, if you clean a bear, I helped a friend shot a bear, and I was helping clean it. They're really shaped extraordinarily like us. Arms, legs, chest,
right.
Organs are in the same place. It's a little disturbing. But you see a bear, I used to have one that visited me a couple times a week at my cabin, and he was a very old male, and then started losing a lot of his fur, splotchy. And his skin was loose, and he would look at me, and I would nod, right? He was asking permission to go to the bird feeder for a big mouthful of sunflower seeds. And so he would walk over, stand up, he's really quite large, take a big mouthful, look at me again, and walk off.
When writing about Native American lore, you know, or particular tribal lore, Do you ever have the fear of either being over-idealizing or patronizing at all? I mean,
no, not too much. See, the trouble is I don't write ever in terms of purebloods. That's them. But what we have in the UP, it's extraordinary, and you have it other places, the United States. When the loggers, the miners, and so on went up there first, there weren't enough women to go around, and many men married Indian women. So there's a huge population of mixed bloods there and many other places in America. You ever read the work of Gerald Visner, who's an extraordinary, extraordinary writer about this mixed blood culture? What's it like to have a foot in both worlds? I lived for 35 years. Oh, gosh, what, 6 miles from the res, and I was even asked to write their tribal history and ended up only writing the introduction to the tribal history. So I don't think I can be patronizing because I look a little strange. I even got kicked out of a strip club once because they said, we don't serve Indians in there. And I says, I'm an Indian? I don't think so. And they said, get out of here. You look like one. You know, that guy. I've written about people I know, and I can't accept any limitations as an artist. I mean, I'm friends with Sherman Alexie and Louise Erdrich. They've never objected to my existence. It's just the mixed blood is a whole different thing. This isn't, I don't enter into things, certain things I do know about and I think are totally inappropriate for me. But everything in this book, in fact, a shaman I know, I knew 25 years before I knew he was the local shaman. That's how secretive chips can be, right? He wrote an essay about his vision quest in Parabola magazine. So this is accessible information. There are some areas of it I don't think we should enter.
You have a character named Flower. Is she, I couldn't tell if she was full blood or...
Yeah, she's pretty much full blood.
Flower makes the comment, of it, and I'm just curious of where this came from. A wet man is like a frog who thinks he is the whole world, that the world starts and ends with him. I notice that most men are like that now.
Yeah, right. Nothing is ever tougher than some of these Indian ladies. I mean, God, you feel nervous. I mean, talk about feeling seen through, you know.
Did that come from someone you knew?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Jim Harrison, it must be quite a jump to go from living in that culture to living in the Hollywood world of Jack Nicholson and Harrison Ford.
Well, it was. And see, one thing, I suppose that why I quit in Hollywood 12 years ago is the essential schizophrenia of I could leave L.A. 24 hours later, I'm at this remote cabin, you know. And so I used to think, here's an illusion people have, that this cabin and these people help me prepare for the world, but they don't. They help you prepare for more of the cabin. In fact, they disprepare you. There's no such word. They disprepare you from the world. So the schizophrenia got too extreme.
You knew John Huston.
Yeah, yeah.
What was he like?
Grandeur, human and spiritual, physical grandeur. Now, he's a great man. Yeah, I adore John. His daughter, too, Angelica, is just a big human, big heart, big mind, those kind of people.
How did they manage to survive in the Hollywood mill?
They were too strong to die. But, you know, John wanted to direct my revenge on Warner, so John Huston will never work for Warners. You know, he pissed off a lot of people out there.
You're listening to an interview with Jim Harrison, whose latest novel is Returning to Earth. Were the only screenplays that actually came out Wolf and Legends
well,
of the Fall?
You know, I had my hand in a lot of stuff. I think 5 or 6 of them, but I don't even think about them anymore. You know, I'm not ashamed of them. It was a good job, and then I got really tired and had to quit.
I keep thinking, as I was looking at your biography, I was thinking of the other writers that I know have gone to Hollywood, written what sounds like great screenplays and walked away with nothing produced. There must be, you know, or these screenplays were completely perverted by the next 100 people who looked at them and their producers.
Well, that happens all the time. I think Bill Whitliff's screenplay for Legends is much better than the one that got made. He got co-credit, but Whitliff, wrote Lonesome Dove. There's nothing better that's been on television about the West. Whitliff is a genius of the West, but purity gets adumbrated out there pretty fast, or mistrust in story. The trouble is that I don't say fault Hollywood more than I do New York publishers, which have become a virtual Walmart of books. So I don't say any big ethical, moral difference between the two. It's preposterous. I get a couple hundred galleys over the transom every year, and I said, you wonder, why are there 300 creative writing colleges or programs, that kind of stuff.
They teach how to write sentences. They don't teach how to tell a story.
Well, they don't teach you how to have a story to tell.
That's true, too.
I
notice you're very popular in France, and your comment about it is that you write dialogue amongst intelligent people, and it occurred to me that that's one of the reasons I enjoy watching films by people like Claude Chabrol or Eric Rohmer. Yeah.
That's not dumb. Well, a French critic said a peculiar thing to me, because I couldn't count. I've had, three or four bestsellers in France, and certainly none here. But he said it was because of my novels. There are thinking people who also do things. Okay, in American novels, it's either just thinking people who don't do anything, or people that do things, and don't think.
What's the difference between plotting a novel and plotting a screenplay, for you at least?
Oh, gosh, not much. I think all action seems to evolve from character. And that was the trouble I had as a screenwriter, where they would always want somebody to be, their fads from year to year. I remember toward the end they wanted me to write about people who become empowered. That was the word that year. And I said, give me a break, I don't know. What's an empowered person? How do you suddenly become empowered? That seemed to be basically fatuous,
Have you ever had a situation where you worked on a screenplay, it was rejected, and you said, wow, this could be a novel, I could work on it into a novel?
Not usually, because it seemed like novels, any novel or novella I've written, I usually thought about for years and years and years. I've taken ideas that I thought could be a novel and then written screenplays about them just because I thought that was a better form. But oddly enough, after I quit writing screenplays, and they paid a fortune to teach me how, I've become quite obsessive about movies now. Netflix, I'm really interested in minutiae of how they're put together. So I think I might try to write one more. I had an idea. Finally an idea, and now I can, if I write the screenplay for Nicholson, I won't have a studio or a producer sticking pins in me or anything. I'm just going to write it for my own interest, and they either will work or not.
And then Nicholson can do what he wants.
Well, if he wishes. He and Sean Penn is who I'm writing it for, because I like Sean's work. I'm just writing it on my own. They know I'm doing it, and that Jack does, but it's just something that interested me.
When you're working, what prompts you to write a short story? A novel gestates for years. A short story may not, or a poem or an essay.
That's an interesting question, because I've never figured it out. I only written technically one short story, but I've written 12 novellas, which are just like long short stories. I don't know. I've written about 25 poems in the last year. But any time I sit down early in the morning, as Wang Wei said in the Tang Dynasty, who knows what causes the opening or closing of the door. I don't know what's going to come that day. You know, usually if I'm working on a novel, I do a couple pages a day and then brood about what comes next. But a poem is most liable, as Yeats said, come out of the medium's mouth. It just is more liable to just hit you with a certain line.
But on some level, I think all fiction and poetry comes out of that. I mean, you know, it's like I remember once talking to Amy Tan, and she made a peculiar comment about going over certain things. I said to her, and later on I didn't realize I'd actually said something. So in other words, you're telling me you're writing the same book over and over again. She said yes.
Well, some people do. I can't. I think sometimes it's caused me problems of accessibility because I do vary widely in my work.
But I also look at a book like Returning to Earth and I see certain things. There's a young woman who died at 25 in the book. Mm-hmm. Absent fathers. Your father died when you were young, but the characters of Cynthia, Donald, Kay, David, all the major characters had to find surrogate fathers.
Yeah, that's interesting. See, that's unconscious in me. You know, that's unconscious. It's interesting how that Willie Valve or Brown Dog being perpetually, randomly fatherless, you know, that kind of thing. That's one reason why it's interesting, you know. But that is an acute observation because I see nothing in a novel can emerge except from what we are, you know.
Right,
what
right.
What we are on Earth.
To some degree, then, it all becomes, in a weird way, whether you're writing about the Roman Empire or you're writing about the future, you're always writing autobiography on
some level. Well, on a certain level, yes. Yeah, specifically, though, some people tend to tell, for a while, McGuane and all of his novels, there was this perpetually revolving father-son conflict.
Jim Harrison, having written Returning to Earth, do you feel you've told David Burkett's story sufficiently now?
Yeah, surely. That's enough. Some people were irked when Delva died. And I says, well, maybe I did it so I could get rid of her. That kind of thing.
Do you ever have characters pop up from other novels like that?
No, occasionally I've done that, but this is enough of this story, I think. You know, because I say that and I might think next year, what is Cynthia doing? You know, because she interests me, this character, this inordinately strong woman. I read the psychiatric literature on this. This is interesting. Under profoundly ugly circumstances, some women are still just inordinately strong and they can't figure out why.
You had a reputation for a while of writing great male characters, but the characters, the female characters in Returning to Earth are spectacular.
Yeah, I think when I wrote Delva in 88 or something, or also there was that novella that was in the New Yorker, The Woman Let by Fireflies. I think around that time in the 80s, I became obsessed with trying to write in the voice of a woman. You know, that's what we're all girls when we start out. Somebody, a scientist, told me that last year.
How do you feel in writing a book with multiple voices and ensuring that the voices all do sound different?
Well, you hope they will, because that's one thing they miss. And so many novels or in movies in particular, everybody sounds the same, where in fact everyone talks quite differently, and then they are coming out from a different body of experience, so they shouldn't sound the same at all. I mean, even brothers and sisters, David and Cynthia sound radically, radically different, because this is how it would be. It's a hard thing sometimes. You know, Goethe said that such a price that God's exact for song to become what we write. Okay. So the trouble is it's sort of hard on you to be all these people. I mean, after you get done, it's like an actor. I remember once with Nicholson, how do you get out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? How do you emerge from that character? or my wife has noticed when I write, like, about Dahl's grandfather in a 200-page stack, I'm walking around stooped over. I'm at, you know, you become, you're like a method actor. You become that person, you know.
What did Nicholson answer when you asked him that?
Well, no, of course you don't emerge from the totally. It takes a while to get out of. You almost have to get into another character to get out of the other one. It's what Walker Percy called the reentry problem, you know.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Marlon Brando?
Yeah, any number of times. Yeah, he was Jack's neighbor, you know.
What was he like?
Powerful, brooding, very, very funny. Very funny. You know, once we were leaving Jack's and Marlon's walking along this driveway, and Jack's teasing me, saying, "Marlon, you're getting a little old." And Marlon leans over and looks in their rearview mirror and starts going like that, you know. And he does and talks about 10 minutes about getting old. And Jack says, "Jesus, I'm really sorry I said that." You know, it completely blew us away. You know, now immensely powerful personality, very divided, you know, resented, I think, finally, that he couldn't make up his own material. That's hard for a lot of them.
Yeah, but Brando generally rewrote all of his dialogue anyway.
Up to a point, yeah, up to a point. Not necessarily in his best work, though. A great actor. Oh, God, you can think of a half dozen. Naturally, they have to be allowed to change dialogue for their own voice. I mean, and sometimes if it's like Sean Penn or Jack or De Niro, a substantial actor or actress, you know, or have an uncanny sense of dialogue. So they have to be able to change it to fit what they perceive of as the character, you know.
Jim Harrison, you're working on a comic novel now?
I already finished a comic novel. I started it 4 days after that to levitate my spirits a bit. But it's a novel I thought about actually 40 years ago when I taught at Stony Brook. It's called The English Major. I was temperamentally unable to teach. I tried it for 2 years, and it just didn't work. I found it incredibly exhausting work, teaching. The parasitic relations with students, you know. If you're any good or enthusiastic, you suddenly have a coterie around you that are draining your blood that you want to save for your writing, you know.
So to that degree, being in Hollywood was less?
Oh, much so. Like, I started out the lowest rung, but at my top, when I quit, I could write a screenplay in 2 months for a price of 5 or 6 times what a full professor gets. So it's a no-brainer.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Harrison, whose latest novel is Returning to Earth. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.